walking over here, I realized I didn't put a slide in on the International Year of the Pulse next year, so I forgot to promote one of the activities that our society is involved with. So 2016, as Dr. Singh indicated, is the International Year of the Pulse. So keep that in mind. So what I want to share with you today is some of our work with dietary fiber and common beans. This project was funded by the Bean Cap. The authors here, second author is a Samira, is a graduate student. I think she might have her PhD by now, from North Dakota State University, that did most of the GWAS. Dimas Echevarria did most of the dietary fiber assays. Henry Thompson's lab in the cancer prevention lab at Colorado State. Leslie Brick is one of my progeny. She actually set up the assay and got it going before she departed to graduate school. And Phil McLean is the director of the Bean Cap program. Common bean is used in many different ways, both as an edible pod and as a dry seed. And what I'll report today is only on the dry seed part, although the pod part is edible. Pods are very interesting, especially when they call them low fiber. It's interesting that many of the non-stringy pods they call low fiber beans. Now, we've never looked at the fiber, but that's the claim. Archaeological records indicate beans were cultivated more than 8,000 years ago. This is a pictograph or a graph in one of the caves of Peru that dates back about 8,000 years. And you can see the little pot of beans there and maize intercropped in many, many years ago. As was mentioned before, dry beans evolved. In the center of origin is now thought to be in southern Mexico, in the circle there. The wild species was dispersed and subsequently thought to have been domesticated independently in two regions, that is the Andean region and the Middle American region. Dr. Siki talked about that and others, so we've seen that. So our interest at Colorado State University, we have a Crops for Health Research Initiative, and the goal of that is to reduce the morbidity and mortality from chronic diseases through improvement of staple crop, primarily by breeding, and disseminate those to the people that need higher nutrition. And our focus is really on discovery, more so than distribution. We just don't have the resources to do that. So we are trying to discover traits that we can reduce morbidity. Primarily, we work with cancer, but in this study, we haven't taken dietary fiber to that extent. Our previous studies have reported on that. So we really want to produce healthier beans, basically. So what is dietary fiber? Dietary fiber has physiological effects in the human gut digestive system that have been known to have very documented effects on laxation, primarily blood cholesterol attenuation and blood glucose attenuation. Lesser effects have been associated with type 2 diabetes, obesity, and to a much lesser extent, some of the chronic diseases. So fiber is also known to play a role in some of those diseases, but it's been less well documented. Probably type 2 diabetes is the best one. So as mentioned before, dietary fiber, our recommendations is 21 to 40 grams per day, depending upon your caloric intake. That rule is about 9 grams per 1,000 calories of intake, kilocalories of intake. So depending upon how many calories you eat, will dictate about the amount of dietary fiber that you should eat to be healthy and uptake of nutrients and so forth, but the actual consumption is about half of that. So we're not eating enough dietary fiber, not only in this country, but throughout the world. So what is dietary fiber? The word really didn't exist until about 1953, when Eben Hipsley first used the term dietary fiber, and it has been visited over and over again, most recently in 2009, where the AOAC revisited what components should be in dietary fiber and how to assay that. In 2009, the AOAC came out with a new method to evaluate dietary fiber that separated three components: soluble, insoluble dietary fiber, and the oligosaccharides. Prior to 2009 and finally accepted in 2011, oligosaccharides were not considered dietary fiber. So this is a labeling concern. If you look at the labels on most food products today, and if you look at the labels for dietary fiber of most food products today, it doesn't contain the oligosaccharides. We just haven't caught up with the assay. And so another part of what we're doing is trying to look at all of the pulse crops, chickpea, peas, lentils, and reevaluate their dietary fiber content with this new 2011 assay. So this research, we want to determine soluble and insoluble dietary fiber, oligosaccharide content, and then finally, with the beaten cap, look at GWAS, genome-wide association studies, to determine regions of the genome or our putative genes that control these three components. We looked at 284 dry bean cultivars from the Middle American gene pool only. Primarily, we limited ourselves to that because that's what was originally sequenced and genotyped by sequence rather than any Indian line. So this is all Middle American material. We used the 6KI Select Illumina SNP chips to do the genome-wide studies. So I have three slides here about the assay to evaluate and calculate dietary fiber. The communication I want to make is that it's 3 days. It takes 3 days to get an assay through. You pretty much soak the bean overnight, autoclave it, basically cook it, homogenize it, and then we store it at minus 40 until we get ready for the next part, the next day, so to speak, where we enzymatically digest the soluble dietary fiber with the kit with pancreatic alpha amylase, aminoglucosidase, and for 16 hours. So you have another day involved with that. And then the third day, you actually do the filtrations, which takes another about 12 to 14 hours. So you have two gravimetric filtrations. The first one takes out the insoluble, or what often is called the high molecular weight dietary fiber. And the second one takes out the soluble dietary fiber. After the second filtrate, the solute that goes through contains the oligosaccharides, and we use HPLC to evaluate those. And then you have to dry the residue from the filtrate and then put it into a fairly lengthy equation to do the calculation. I'm not going to go through that equation with you. The sequencing was done in cooperation with the Bean Cap and several other funding, two other sources of funding from DOE and ARAA. These are the folks that were involved with that. I had nothing to do with the sequencing. I'm an applied plant breeder, and they were so kind as to genotype the material and share the data with us, and we basically did the GWAS in collaboration with North Dakota State to find these candidate genes. This is some information about the genomic sequencing, not related, but basically the genome was well covered in terms of the SNP profiles that they found. They found 11 chromosomes, and about 27,000 genes were identified. So in this population, we phenotyped for IDF, SDF, and oligosaccharides, raffinose, stachyose, and verbascose. As I said, they were genotyped with the SNP chip. So we'll keep going here. So first of all, I'll talk about the content of among the 284 lines, and I'll talk about the studies and then candidate gene discovery. So I condensed my slides into, I think I have six. No, I have four, I believe. We can slow down here a little bit. Basically, when we looked at these 284 entries, what you see here is a table with the top entries, the top five entries, and the lowest five entries for total dietary fiber. So if we go over here to total dietary fiber, and these two columns do not sum to the third because oligos are not shown here, and they're added into that total. if you look at the literature and find out what how much dietary fiber is in beans, that number is used. Do I have the wrong? I got olives. Hang on. There we go. Yes, there we go. That number is usually reported in into the 17 to 20% range, and you'll see that our numbers are about 3 or 4 units higher than that, and that's really the difference between having oligos in there and not having them in there. So the range of total dietary fiber up here was 22.8 to 30.2, quite a bit higher than it's reported, 33% pretty much than what the labels say. So without doing anything, we increased dietary fiber of beans, and that's pretty great accomplishment without doing anything, so other than using the new assay. Varieties differed greatly, the highs of about 30 and down here to 22, so it gives us hope that there's genetic variation that we can exploit, and I'll can talk a little more about that in a bit. As far as oligosaccharides, raffinose, dactylose, and verbascose. Dactylose was the highest content at about 3%, very little verbascose, and not a lot of raffinose, which has been reported previously. 3.5 to 6% total. Again, it gives us encouragement that there's genetic variability. And when we looked at genome-wide association studies, these are our Manhattan plots, and I know these they're named Manhattan plots because it looks like the Manhattan skyline. And what we look at is it cut off this horizontal line, and we look at these dots. These are individuals that came above that line in terms of LOD score. That's a probability that there's a high association. So when you see those peaks and you go across the genome at the bottom of the 11 chromosomes, for example, we go up here on chromosome 1, and there's a fragile fiber gene, a candidate gene we discovered, that's associated with insoluble and soluble dietary fiber, and of course the total. So if you look across the genome of the 11 chromosomes, we saw candidate genes on chromosome 1, 2, and several on chromosome 8. So, excuse me, when we look at candidate gene discovery, yeah, there we go. Thank you. I shouldn't have had that cigar this morning, probably. Anyway, if we look at candidate gene discovery up here, you look at the kinds of genes that were that are in the region of these peaks. Raffinose, where for the fiber, fragile fiber, clearly could be related to dietary fiber. Cellulose synthetase gene, a gene that's involved in the pathway of producing cellulose. And look at these are all precursors of fibers. So they're very good candidate genes in terms that they make sense, and we think that they're highly likely involved. When we look at the oligosaccharides, raffinose, dactylose, verbascose, and the total, again, we hit right on top of raffinose synthetase on chromosome 1. Glucose transferase and beta-glucosidase are all enzymes that involve the early pathway of oligo. Again, all of these are very likely genes involved in the pathways. And with these markers, these SNP markers, we should be able to use them as markers for selection. So again, the tools should help us alter the profile of soluble and insoluble dietary fiber. This is just a table that shows that, again, these genes are originally out of Arabidopsis with the Centini with the soybean genome and subsequently to the dry bean genome. And we feel like we have excellent candidate genes that are likely involved in the traits we discovered. Here's the verbascose, again, dactylose synthetase, and some of these precursor enzymes involved in the production. So in conclusion then, when chromosome 8, we found several good hits were involved with all three, soluble, insoluble, and total dietary fiber. On chromosomes 1 and 2, PV is phaseolus vulgaris, chromosome 1 and 2 were detected for only insoluble, so we feel that those are specific for the types of fibers that are not soluble. And GWAX peaks and Canada genes for raphanostachyosynthetase was involved, and it's likely we landed very close to that, pretty much right on top of it. So the results do suggest that we should be able to use these markers in selection programs and in almost design a profile that's desirable, whether you want a lot of insoluble fiber and low soluble, or vice versa. If you like, people reported earlier today about prebiotics, oligos being prebiotics. Some people don't want oligos because they're associated with flatulence, so maybe you can have it one variety one way and another variety the other way, and as a breeder, that's what we really set out to do. So it looks very encouraging that we should have some tools here to change dietary fiber content and quality in dry edible beans. So with that, thank you very much. Here's our team, a very small part of our team in the bean cap that worked on this. Thank you very much. The question is about whether we just look, whether we included the seed coat. We homogenized the whole seed after we cooked it, so we included it as it would be consumed. I think it'd be interesting to look at the two. Clearly, some of the insoluble fiber would be in the seed coat. Our intent was to look at it from a breeder's perspective and not worry about removing seed coat or as it's consumed by humans. Dr. Vandermark.
Mark, that was excellent showing how it takes about 3 days to do that fiber assay. And I'm wondering if anyone's made an effort to try to calculate just about how much it costs per assay.
Yeah, well, you can get it done. There's a lab in Minneapolis that does it. It costs $450, one assay. And so we had 284 lines, two reps, and we had a subset of two locations. So it took us about a year, and a little over a year and a half to run the 284, and then another half a year to run the other location. So, yeah, it's not something you want to, you know. I don't highly recommend getting into TDF assays. Outsourcing, yeah. If you can afford $450, you're all set. Dr. Shanahan. I'm a former 4-H person, and we used IDF. They use NIR. Most of the NIR are about, you know, exciting the molecules, and most of those would fall into the insoluble dietary fiber here. The soluble parts are usually, they go into solution, go through the filter, and they are not detected very well. But animals can digest them. A cow can digest what we call insoluble. A cow can digest it in its first stomach. We don't have that ability because we can't break the bonds. And by definition, fiber is what goes through the, goes in one end and comes out the other, so to speak. Okay, so eat your beans, okay? Half a cup a day is all we ask. Thank you.
Could we please give two things? We have a few minutes after we announce the winners of the C9 Division student competition. We have a few minutes for the to ask questions of the speakers that are still here. So I'm going to turn over to Brian momentarily, and then back to me.
Okay, thank you. I'm just going to quickly announce the winners of the graduate student poster competition. I don't think any of them are here, but regardless, I'd like to thank the graduate students for making their posters and presenting them to us. We had a panel of four that went around and viewed all the entries. And by consensus of the panel, the first place goes to Crystal Heim from University of Missouri.